Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, chapter 26, Fundamental Principles of Material Nature, text 36. I can't read it. Mridutvam katinatvam cha. No, we did that. Sorry. Yeah, 37. That was a different verb. You did. Chalanam vyuhanam praptir. Netritvam dravya sabdayo. Sarvendriyanam atmatmam. Vayo karma bilakshana. Chalanam vyuhanam praptir. Netritvam dravya sabdayo. Sarvendriyanam atmatvam. Vayo karma bilakshanam. Chalanam. Moving. Vyuhanam. Mixing. Prapti. Allowing approach. Netritvam. Carrying. Sound and other sense perceptions, and providing for the proper functioning of all other senses. Purport. We can perceive the action of the air when the branches of a tree move, or when dry leaves on the ground collect together. Similarly, it is only by the action of the air that a body moves, and when the air circulation is impeded, many diseases result. Paralysis, nervous breakdowns, madness, and many other diseases are actually due to an insufficient circulation of air. In the Ayurvedic system, these diseases are treated on the basis of air circulation. If from the beginning one takes care of the process of air circulation, such diseases cannot take place. From the Ayurveda as well as from the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is clear that so many activities are going on internally and externally because of air alone. And as soon as there's some deficiency in the air circulation, these activities cannot take place. Here it is clearly stated, Netridvam dravya sabdayo, our sense of proprietorship over action is also due to the activity of the air. If the air circulation is stifled, we cannot approach a place after hearing. If someone calls us, we hear the sound because of the air circulation, and we approach that sound or the place from which the sound comes. It is clearly said in this verse that these are all movements of the air. The ability to detect odors is also due to the action of the air. Nice, chatter. Omagyanati mirandasya kinandana salakya sakshura nilitam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. Here it is described how the air is not only manifest in the wind that moves around leaves on branches or dry leaves on the ground, but it is further described how the air works within the body, something which we are a little less aware of, how many functions within the body are dependent on air. One of the points that is being mentioned here is that movements are within the body depend on air, which is something a little awkward to the Western mind, right? Where we just think in terms of muscles and electric signals coming, you know, through the central nerve system, and that's basically it, right? As far as we're concerned, we never put air into the equation. But somehow or other, in the Ayurveda, there is the concept that all movements are related to air, and that the joints are cushioned by air, right? That there are basically air cushions within the joints, and when the air cushions in the joints are no longer there, then you have arthritis, right? So these are examples of diseases coming forth out of disturbed air or poisoned air as they are saying, amvata. Am is poison, poisonous substance. When in the body the digestion process is not properly taking place, the result is that jaturagni, which is burning up the foodstuffs, is not adequately burning them up and then producing am, or producing poison in the system. If that poison becomes somehow or other mixed with the vata, then that poisonous vata or poisonous air pollutes the functioning in the entire body. And the result is that one can get so many diseases. It is said that there are 39 diseases or something like that, if I remember it correct, that come forth of that. And one of them is madness, which is mentioned here. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, at an early age, began to display symptoms of madness. After his father had left to Gaya, Nimai was, not long after that, became quite unreasonable. He asked his mother, right, that he wanted to worship the Ganges. And she said, "Yes, my boy, of course. Just wait a minute and I'll bring you the ingredients." And she went to bring a tray for aarti and a garland, etc. But Nimai said, no, I don't want to wait. I want it now. And he became totally unreasonable. He went into a fit. He kicked his legs. He stretched his arms. He hit the ground. Then he bounced up and he grabbed the first stick he could get his hands on. He just went around the house. He beat everything he could and broke it, all the cooking pots. Then he ripped open all the bags with foodstuff and threw it on the ground and stamped on it until the whole kitchen was just lying over the floor. And he broke whatever other furniture there was in the house. And finally he started battering the wall with that stick and just smashed all the walls with the stick. And then he fell on the ground again, beat it a little more, and finally went to sleep. So Mother Sachi, right, somehow or other, from all the piles from all the broken remnants of whatever was there, took some foodstuffs and managed to prepare some sort of lunch. And Nimai just sat down and took lunch as if nothing was happened, very peaceful, and she just served it out as if nothing had happened. And just the only thing she said at the end is, "My dear Nimai, now that you have done this, right, I don't know how I will be serving the next meal," right? And Nimai just made a remark saying, like, "You are worrying about all these things, you know," and just produced a tola. A tola is a thumb, right? It's about the size of a thumb. He produced a tola of gold, right? So, a tola of gold. And there she was looking at this gold. Where does he get it from, you know? Like, I mean, how does he do this? And in this way, Nimai had solved the situation and everything went on. But from time to time, it happened that Nimai was having fits, right? And that he would just crash to the ground. So the understanding that Nimai was suffering from epileptic fits, right, has rooted, and the reputation started then. Some people thought that, oh yes, that's what's wrong with him. It is a vata disturbance, and therefore he sometimes falls to the ground, right? And some people wanted to treat him for it. Amongst modern academics, right, sometimes that understanding has been maintained, you know, that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was regularly crashing to the ground because he was suffering from epileptic fits. Right? Of course, this is the lowest and most primitive level of academics. There are certainly academics who have a much deeper understanding of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But the fact remains that one cannot understand Chaitanya Mahaprabhu through mundane learning. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's crashing to the ground when he was still a boy, Nimai Pandit, became a problem in the family. And therefore, Mother Sachi called Srivas Pandit to come and look at the situation. And he said, oh, your son has a very, very fortunate kind of epileptic fits. I want to have them also. He said. Mother Sachi was just worried and just hoping that it could be cured somehow or other so that Nimai wouldn't crash to the ground anymore. We see that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu sometimes, while dancing in the kirtan, surrounded by devotees, would ecstatically dance and throw his body high up in the air in long curves and circling around very fast, and then would just crash to the ground with so much force that everyone was sure that his bones would have been pulverized, right? Crushed. So the devotees were just, it was too painful to see for them that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was smashing on the ground like that. And Lord Nityananda personally made it his service to catch him. That became his main thing in the kirtans, to catch Lord Chaitanya. Well, there he goes. Quick. Right? Grab him. Right? And Lord Nityananda was just all along on edge, you know, his muscles flexed and ready to jump in any direction to catch Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And other devotees, equally so, were very concerned with that. But still, the Lord, from time to time, would crash to the ground. Crash. Not just gently fall, but just hit the ground with great force. So, the mundane personalities thought it was due to an air deficiencies, that the air circulation was stifled within the body of the Lord. But of course, we know, Angani yasya sakalindriya vritti manti pasyanti palayanti chiram jaganti. We know that the Supreme Lord does not have a material body. Rather that his body is fully transcendental and that the functions of his body are interchangeable, that he can see with his hands, that he can hear with his eyes or taste simply through smell, that the Lord can do anything and everything, and that certainly within his body there is no air circulation, but that his body is made of pure transcendental bliss and knowledge and eternity. It is of a different nature. It is a satsidananda vigraha, right? That the Vaishnava understands. In that context, the Lord was not dependent on these things. Still, we see that the devotees were treating him in a personal way, and therefore we see that some devotees were offering Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu medicinal remedies. They were offering him sukta. Sukta is one type, a mixture of vegetables which has one bitter ingredient in it, chlorella, also known as bitter melon, that bitter vegetable. And then it has some squash vegetables like Loki, which is in the family of the courgettes, and it has some potatoes, and just like this way, it's a mix of vegetables, and shukta is bitter. Not too bitter, a little bitter. Tasty, emit a bit of a sauce. Right? It's quite good, shukta. And this shukta is being served in Bengal to cut the bile in the system. The bile that is necessary to break down fat. If we eat lots of fatty foods, right, then we get lots of bile in the system. and more bile than we can use is kind of stored first within the stomach and then goes into the intestinal tract, right? And it is explained that there it's just remaining. Bile can also come if you are getting too much annoyed all the time about things, too much irritation, you know, when you are very irritated about many things all the time, then you'll get like bile, and it burns, right? It has a burning effect, and that bile will just enter somewhere in the intestines, and it will just cause all kinds of other effects. And the side effect is it can also start affecting the functioning of the air. So then the bile will, due to its burning effect, upset the balance of the air. All this is Ayurveda. So, therefore, the Sukta was given to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He was given Sukta to help him overcome all the opulent meals he had to take, right? They thought, he's a sannyasi, and you know how it is. It's the social custom to feed the sannyasi, and look how much they're feeding him, right? Huge quantities of meals. They put so much on his plate. Let me make some sukta for him, right? So that he can deal with all the extra bile that is there due to all this overindulgence in eating, right? Everything they make him eat. In this way, the devotees were caring for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Also, there is one oil called Narayan Til. Narayan Til is one oil which has a cooling effect, and it is especially used in vata disorder to arrest the vata and to dissolve the vata which is in the wrong places. Right. So this Narayan Til was applied on the head of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to cure him from his madness. Right? So in this way, the devotees were looking after Nimai and later on after Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and cared for his health. This dropping to the ground was not only a pastime of the Lord, it is also described that others also had this. Mukunda is described was a doctor, right? And he was a vaidya, and he was the personal attendant of the local Mohammedan governor, right? And so on one occasion, he was there, and the governor was seated on a throne, and someone was fanning him with a peacock fan. And when he saw those peacocks, when he saw the feathers of that peacock fan, it got to him, and it just totally absorbed him, and he also crashed to the ground. He fell from a raised podium, a raised platform, and just fell on the ground. And the king was shocked, you know, his doctor just drops on the ground there. And it's not what you want from a doctor, isn't it, that he gets sick? Because, you know, who do you call, right? It's a complication, you know. So there was a problem there. Anyway, the king therefore personally did what he could to bring him to his senses. And when he came to external senses, then the king said, "What happened?" And he said, "Oh, I am suffering from some disease, you know, sometimes I have an air imbalance, and sometimes it happens to me." But the king said, "It happened when you saw the peacock fan. Tell me more." Right? So the king was not a fool. The king understood straight away what was going on. And the king turned out to have more knowledge than you would expect from a Mohammedan, because he knew very well that the peacock feather was connected to Krishna. And therefore he could understand immediately that Mukunda was a great devotee, and actually secretly the king was very attracted to Krishna consciousness, and therefore inquired from him, and turned out very quickly made spiritual advancement, right? Actually had a great spiritual depth, and therefore could immediately relate to the whole thing, and could totally understand what was going on, and appreciate. Yes. So In this way, we see that sometimes amongst the Muslim rulers in India, there were very elevated personalities, very like Akbar. In the museum in Agra, there is a drawing, right, where we see that Akbar is meeting Sanatan Goswami in Vrindavan, and he's paying full rupa in Sanatan, sorry, and he's paying full dandavats to them, full. Right? He's lying flat on the ground. Right? That drawing is there. No photos allowed. So we need some devotee on a mission in to go in that museum and just take a sneaky picture of that painting so that we can publish it, right, in our BBT productions, right, and gain fame, increase the fame of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his followers. And it is a fact that it was Akbar who built the Radha Govinda temple of Rupa Goswami, the seven-story high temple. He had it done by one of his generals, Man Singh, right, who took up this work. And that is how Rupa Goswami was able to construct such a big temple. Of course, later it was Aurangzeb who was sitting in Agra, 60 kilometers away, and saw the big flame on the roof of the ghee lamp, which was so huge that the light was even seen from the distance of Agra to Vrindavan. It clearly lit up the sky even in Agra, right, 60 kilometers away. So that must have been quite a fire. And I mean, can you imagine making a fire here in Amsterdam, which can be seen in Rotterdam? Huh? It's inconceivable, but something like that. So that must have been quite something. Of course, it was dark, and there was not so much light pollution as there is today. You know, so things reflected in the sky, but nonetheless, that must have been a serious little ghee lamp up there, right? Which they always kept going. So what a temple that must have been, right? Huge temple with an enormous ghee lamp. So we can see how Akbar was a great devotee of the Lord, actually, to construct such a glorious temple with such a special lamp on it so that people from far would be attracted to go there. And it is said in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that this Radha Govinda temple was the most wonderful temple, that it was a temple where daily thousands of devotees were worshipping the Lord. It didn't say thousands of pilgrims were coming, but from the way that the verses are written in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we get the impression that there were thousands of devotees engaged in worshipping the Lord on a regular basis. So that is what we think. It looks like there were thousands of devotees living around this temple and just coming and serving C.C. Radha Govindaji. If it's not surprising that nowadays in Jaipur still we see how Govindaji is being worshipped by thousands. It really is still going on. Govindaji seems to want thousands and no less, right? And it is like that. The deity is in control. You know, don't think he's there and that we are making all the arrangements. No, we are allowed to make the arrangements, but he is making the arrangements. Right? Anyway, he's very nicely taken care of. He even has a watch, right? After all, in India, you know, if you don't have a watch, you don't count, right? You are a low aboriginal. You must have a watch, right? Everybody must have a watch in India today, you know, like otherwise, forget it, right? The best is, the bigger it is, the better your watch, right? If your watch is huge and fat and as big as an alarm clock, now that's a watch, you know, right? So Govindaji has a nice watch, right? Nice. And so in this way, in India, they are very, creative in their offerings to the Lord, right? You see that in Nath Dwar that they have their a Balagopal deity, and as Krishna in his child form, And when they make offerings to him, they offer him toys. Huh? He sits there with a whole bunch of toys, a rattle and some other things, because he's Krishna in a child form. And so, you know, you offer the child toys. So it is very personal in India. It's different. You know, here we'd say, well, but is this authorized? Is this according to the rituals? Is this according to the scriptures? Right? We would say, but in India they say, chalega, chalega, bhai. It will do. It's nice because Krishna, he likes. Of course he likes. No? He likes. He's Balagopal. He likes to make these offerings in this way. Yes. So this actually is a different level of worshipping the Supreme Lord. We see that among some of the followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the devotees developed a very extraordinary standard of worshipping the deity. We can think of Bamsidas Babaji, who always had the deity hanging around his neck in a cloth and who just day and night be talking to his deity. Right? He hardly spoke to people, sometimes a few words here and there, but he spoke the whole day to his deity. Big conversations, and it was clear that Krishna spoke back and that there was a whole thing going on. And they were arguing at times, right? It wasn't just like in awe and reverence, no. He was sometimes chastising his deity and totally disagreeing with his deity, etc. And some people were witnessing it all, and it was going on like that. So we can see that Krishna appreciates. We can also remember that Govindaji was found by Sanatan Goswami in the house of a Brahmana in Mathura, and that this Brahmana was treating the deity as one of his sons. He had many sons, and during prasadam, they would just carry the deity, put the deity there in the row, you know, sitting on the floor, said putting him next to the others and serve him a plate of prasadam. Yeah? And that's how the deity was being served. And Sanatan Goswami was abhorred, you know. I mean, it's like, how can this illiterate Brahmana do this? You know, what kind of Brahmana is this? Doesn't he know any scripture? And so he told him, he said, this is not at all acceptable. You know, there are standards. I mean, you should put the deity under the care of a Brahmana who knows the scriptures, who follows the scriptures, and who properly will take care. So the other illiterate, so-called illiterate Brahmana was very humble and immediately said, oh, well, if a great saintly personality like yourself is ordering me as such, then what can I do? Then what can I do? I must abide by your order. You please take the deity. No. How can I take the deity? No, I didn't want that. I didn't mean that. I meant you find someone. No, sir. I have found someone. You are the only one. There is no one but you that I have faith in who can take care of Sri Govinda Dev. Right? So, you know, the Brahmana was very convincing and determined. Suddenly, there was no way that he was going to keep the deity, and only Sanatana Goswami had to take him. So that day, Sanatana Goswami came home with a deity. You know, he had only gone around to get some chapatis. It was a bit of a shock. So he didn't quite know what to do with the deity, because he really didn't have an altar or a temple or anything like that. And he also didn't want to put the deity just in the dirt on the ground. So finally, after thinking about it, he hung the deity with cloth in a tree. Right? He just put some cloth and tied the deity hanging from a branch in the tree. So there the deity was hanging like that, you know, with pieces of cloth. Some are strapped or under the arms. So, you know, Krishna didn't mind. He was hanging there. But that night, Sanatana Goswami had a dream wherein Krishna appeared and told him, he said, why did you tell that Brahmana that, you know, that I wasn't, that it wasn't proper to worship me like that? I was perfectly happy. It was very nice. Huh? So, you know, what was wrong? So then Sanatana Goswami, totally shocked, the next day went back to that Brahmana. But the Brahmana had also had a dream, and in the dream, the deity had said, Sanatan Goswami will come today, and he will tell you that you should take me back, but you should not agree to this. You know, no, I will stay with him. So when Sanatan came to tell about his dream, then the Brahmana gave him tit for tat and gave him his a dream of his own, you know. Just, well, it's like, well, pretty good dream you had there, but wait till you see this one, you know. So that knocked Sanatan Goswami right out of his, well, I guess he wasn't wearing shoes, because in the renounced order in those days, one was going bare feet. But anyway, it blew him right out of the water, as they say. And Sanatan Goswami still had Govindaji. And then we get the further pastimes of where Govindaji gets tired of just chapatis and wants a little salt and all that. And, you know, and gets chastised for it, you know. We are renunciants, you know. You cannot just go for this sense gratification, you know. Why do you want salt just for your tongue, right? For your palate, you know, right? That's totally not required, you know. That is atyahara, right? That is collecting more than required. No. We cannot entertain this. This is sense gratification, right? So Krishna, like, well, I can't even get a little salt, you know. So the Lord was kind of not satisfied with that. And as we see, he arranged for some salt. He did. He arranged first for a storm, and his ship came down to Yamuna and got on the wrong side of the river. And rivers are treacherous, right? There's always, especially along the sides, if you ever sail in a river, sail in the middle of the river. Never come near the sides, because you're sure to get stuck on the ground somewhere, hit a bank. So that's what happened. This boat got blown to the side by the wind and got stuck on the bank. And what to do, you know. The owner came, didn't know what to do. People said, go to Sanatan Goswami. He knows the answer to every question, right? And that was true, because Sanatan was a pure devotee, and the pure devotee knows the answer to every question. And beyond that, Sanatan Goswami had been the prime minister, so he was also quite practical. So he really knew. So when the owner of the ship came to Sanatan Goswami, then at that time he asked what to do, how to get my boat free. And Sanatan Goswami said, pray to Madan Mohan. Right. And anyway, in this way, the whole pastime continued and some salt was there. Now, all these pastimes that take place with the deities in such a way are not to be imitated. They are taking place in the relationship with devotees who are on the transcendental platform. When it comes to rules and regulations, there are two sides of the rules and regulations. Below the rules and regulations, and above the rules and regulations. So the sinful people of this world are below the rules and regulations, and they have to become elevated by following the rules and regulations. But the saintly personalities of this world are beyond the rules and regulations. But it says they will never, ever perform in a sinful activity. Although the great Paramahansas may or may not follow the rules of Krishna consciousness, still they will never, never, ever engage in a sinful activity, because they will never do anything that's not pleasing to the Lord. So they're automatically avoiding sinful life. So this is our process by which we are serving Krishna. Besides embracing the rules of Vaidhi Bhakti, the next thing is that we are treating Krishna like a person and give him special attention and personal attention. And if we do so, if we just chant and dance with enthusiasm in front of the Lord and go out of our way to give him personal attention, then we too will become transcendental madman. Just like in the Adi Lila chapter 7 of Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is described how that famous verse where it is said that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, my spiritual master told me to chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. And the result is that I became mad. Right? I became mad. Then I went before my spiritual master and I immediately presented this problem before him. Immediately. It's mentioned in the purports that one should do so. Whenever there is a complication, whenever there is some matter that one cannot resolve, any doubt, immediately clarify, without delay. So he did. And his spiritual master was very, very pleased. He said, this is very, very wonderful. You are very fortunate. It is very rarely attained. You have attained the most desirable thing. I am very happy. And the spiritual master was very, very pleased to see that his disciple had become so glorious. So, like this, by this chanting of Hare Krishna and dancing in front of the deity spontaneously and serving the deity with enthusiasm and trying to make special arrangements for the satisfaction of the deity, we will, in a happy mood, right, in a mood of susukam kartamaviyam, joyfully performed, then we will certainly experience the same madness that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was displaying, which is the goal of this movement, the secret of all secrets, that which we are not telling anyone, but just keep amongst ourselves, is that the purpose of this movement is to drive everyone totally mad. Any questions? Yes. Well, that's a good sign. Making spiritual advancement.
About this, Sanatana Goswami was worshipping
Govinda. That was true. I made a little mix up there. Yeah, mix up for myself. No, it was Govinda Ji. It was Madan Mohan all the way. Yes, it was Madan Mohan all the way. And Govindaji also, in a similar way, was found. Yes.
When the Acharya find discover
I don't know anything about Advaita Acharya. Sorry. No. Well, I mean, you can go and check that and research it. I think it's too premature to make such a blanket statement, right? But who knows? You know, there may be some reference in some scripture somewhere, but apparently that's not the essence. Right? The essence in worshiping the deity is not just following the scriptures, but one can make some personal additions, right? One can, at times of festivals, make special arrangements, special decorations, special things. It's not just that you can only use flowers for decoration and everything else is sinful, right? There are many other things that one can use for decoration and have been done. There have been like waterfalls made behind the deities on the festival. In Vrindavan, we've had two calves on the altar with Krishna and Balaram, a brown one and a white one on Balaram's appearance day, with some straw in front, etc. So many arrangements we've had, yeah, over the years. Yeah. A little creativeness in deity worship is certainly also part. Special festivals for the glorification of the deity are very nice. And it's not that one has to dare always see, like, well, something in this scripture, that scripture. No, that is, some spontaneity is appreciated there. We see many examples of spontaneous worship like that. And in Vrindavan, we see how that's the culture. That's the culture. Besides keeping up the standard of prescribed deity worship, there are certain spontaneous things and certain standards, and there are some differences in different temples. Like Prabhupada was always glorifying the standard of deity worship in the Radharaman temple. So, you know, because the deity is small, therefore the deity has its own dinner room, right? Unlike other deities who just stay on the altar and we just go, you know, eat a masana, etc. There, they move the deity and bring him to his own room where he takes his meals, right? Now, if we would, like, you know, if pujaris would suddenly start doing that in one of our temples, you know, hey, where are you going? Oh, I'm taking Krishna to prasadam, you know. Right? Some of us might not be so impressed. But we see that there, they developed that principle. And it's just part of a very elaborate system of worship. So such variations are found in temples. And yeah, Prabhupada told us to specifically look at the standards in the Radharaman temple. And Krishna Kshetra Prabhu is actually, for his dissertation, done a lot of research on that standard. Not only there, he's gone beyond that, but he got the whole puja manual from the Radharaman temple, and, you know, he made friends with them and eventually pulled it out of them and studied their standards, etc. So we can see there is some variety in these things. Yes?
Why should the doubt be presented to me?
Okay. I think the word immediately may be interpreted in various ways. Immediately, one can take it literally, that very same instant, right? as the thought comes into the head, you know. Yeah, hello, Haribo, Haribo. I had this terrible thought that just came into my mind, and I have to clarify this. That's also, I don't think that is what is required. But it is good to take these doubts before the spiritual master. One should, though, see the category of the doubts, you know. Like, you know, I mean, I have in me some resistance to get up in the morning, you know, and I thought this is a real problem. Will this grow into an anartha that will strangle my bhakti creeper, you know? Get off the mental platform and just get out of bed and everything will be all right. Eventually it will go away. That would be the answer. In other words, there is a level of questions and doubts which are just trivial. And if trivial doubts are all the time presented before the spiritual master, it becomes a form of harassment. And it begins to disturb his activities. So, and if one just asks every question about the obvious, you know, then which can easily be answered by so many other spiritually experienced devotees, then it is not required to bring that to the spiritual master. One may just clarify it through the general consensus of the devotees, right? But when we speak about more fundamental levels or more important matters, right, that are affecting us our life in more major ways. And any doubt about a major element in life must be presented before the spiritual master. Right? And then, immediate, why wait, right? And then we may think like, well, let me just put this in the right form, you know, because like, I mean, I may be misunderstood if I don't present myself properly, and then to put it before an absolute authority, you know, that could be dangerous, right? If the form in which I present my case is not clear. So therefore, let me then think about it 20 times, how to present it. Yes, that's one way, but there's not necessarily so much gain with that. The other way, to be like more childlike and innocent and just, you know, present it as it comes spontaneous, oftentimes gets a lot of direct response of the spiritual master. I noticed this in myself in the past that, you know, that we Europeans are a little reserved, right, by our tradition and culture. So when I came in Australia, I saw that the Australians were so open with their spiritual master. They just put their heart out all the time, right on the table, in front of everyone. And I was looking again, wow, you know, look at that question, you know. So honest, so open, you know. I would have never, you know, reveal my inner life like that, you know, bang. Right? But they did. And I saw that they got, oftentimes, very nice instructions, which, you know, I also filed, right, and took advantage of to deal with my own questions. So there is something to say for just being childlike, open, honest, and just present one's case spontaneous. One should just accept whatever the spiritual master says, whether it's sweet or heavy. Ultimately, we should trust that it's for our benefit. So, we should have quite an open relationship, if possible. Any other question?
And the point was, if you have circulation,
yeah, whether it is channels, right? That's one particular addition that you make in your visualization of the distribution of air. I don't see anything. I've never read anything about channels, right? But somehow or other, you know, the air is circulating through the body, right? Whether the air has the capacity to find subtle means of penetration, right, through the tissue, etc., or the bones. It seems to be clear that the air is working in connection with the bones. Right, it is mentioned that the air has several centers in the body where it is active. Right? I mean, I don't remember all of them by heart like this, but there are some major centers where air is concentrated in the body and from where it is distributed. Right? Yeah. Of course, chest is an area, but there's, besides that the breathing is going on, there's a storage area of air there. Right? Other parts, also within the joints, the air is stored there, that I know, that I remember. But there were other places, maybe also the central nerve system in the back, if I remember it correctly, the air was stored there. So like that, air is stored in several places in the body, but I have not read anywhere in any book about channels. But anyway, somehow or other, the air is distributed to the body. And there's different airs. There's the apana, the downward air, the udana, upward air, the vyana, which shrinks and expands. Right? So like that, there are different airs. You remember any others? There are five. Huh? You remember the names of the others? I understand it, if I can just get the names. Samana, for the equilibrium. Samana maintains the equilibrium in the body. And then the next? That I missed? No, that you just said. Samana, Udana was downwards. In the Apana, Udana was upwards. So I had that. Vyana I had. There's one missing. Prana. You're right. Very good. Prana distributes the energy to the body. Yeah. It's like... So the prana energy is the energy of Krishna, which is all-pervading in the universe and also active within our body. So this prana is then distributing energy through our entire body. That way the airs are functioning. And these are all vayu, five types. Yes, these are five types. It said in you remember in the city of nine gates how the serpent of the life airs is protecting the gates, right? And those are the five. It's a five-hooded serpent. Yeah. Yes. Before Lord Chaitanya? Only in Madhavendra Puri. Only. Somehow or other. He was the first one to exhibit it. Otherwise, no. They were not there. But Madhavendra Puri had it. And therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu met several devotees who had it. And they always... When they met each other, they were amazed that they had it, and then they would speak, and then they would find out that they'd have some connection with Madhavendra Puri. Right? Those persons were either disciples of Madhavendra Puri, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was a grand disciple of Madhavendra Puri. So in this way, and it is said several times, that without a connection with Madhavendra Puri, one cannot have love of God. It's not possible. One cannot attain love of God without a connection with Madhavendra Puri. So it is stated. Therefore, Madhavendra Puri, his biography is given in the Madhya Lila, right, of Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's an essential. So it's not just, oh, nice story about Madhavendra Puri. Just see, you know, like, what a great devotee was he, you know. And, well, I'll definitely put it in my file of great devotees, together with all the other, few hundred that are glorified in amongst the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. And Madhavendra Puri is certainly one. Deserves all respect from the sweet rice, etc. Very nice. No, without a connection with Madhavendra Puri, one cannot attain love of God. He's essential. Right? Even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu needed to have a connection with Madhavendra Puri. That's how the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came through Madhavendra Puri in a special way. That somehow or other he had that. There, Madhavendra Puri had a very difficult situation because there was no one like him in the entire world. No one. So wherever he went, he never met anybody who loved to speak about Krishna as much as he did. Nobody. And wherever he went, he just didn't find anyone until he met Lord Nityananda. And then, as a result, because he finally, after so long, met the person who loved to speak about Krishna as much as he did, the two of them embraced and then just rolled over the ground and lost it and kicked, etc. And all the disciples were just standing there in amazement. Iswara Puri was there. Ramachandra Puri were there. And they were all watching. And they couldn't believe what was happening to their spiritual master. And who was this other person? And what were they doing? And, I mean, making such a mess of themselves. But they could at the same time see that it was totally transcendental. And they were just amazed. Wow. Right? So, Madhavendra Puri was such a devotee. Amazing, amazing, amazing devotee in whom the greatest ecstasy of love of God manifested. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu obviously arranged that so that he too could come in a line of disciplic succession and show that, you know, this was essential. And therefore, Madhavendra Puri was somehow or other specially blessed and empowered by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, right? Prior to appear, before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's appearance, and to already display this high level of love of God. Some arrangement of the Lord necessary to establish the Sampradaya. I don't know. Who's the spiritual master of Madhavendra Puri? Some connection with Lord Nityananda. You hear these kind of things in on the periphery. You know, there are all these little things on com or on computer files. You know, you get like stacks of computer files, the computer library, and in there you find tidbits of information, and there you find all these kind of things. So that's like we have to be a little. If we don't find anything in the main literatures, then it's not mainstream information. So we're kind of, don't make a big thing of it if you find some little file like that, unless it's kind of further confirmed by the acharyas. No. The reason was that he wanted to worship the Ganges, and he didn't want to wait. She said he had to wait, so he would bring the paraphernalia. He refused to wait. He didn't want to wait. He wanted it immediate. To understand, he's the Supreme Lord. Waiting is not. Is not a necessity in his pastime, because time is such a thing for the Lord, right? Why would things have to take time? So from the transcendental point of view, why time? So he didn't want time. Yeah. So some may consider it mad, but the Lord is transcendental to material restriction. And the whole pastime is transcendental. Lord Chaitanya was very wild and restless, very energetic. When he was a kid, as a boy, he used to just roam around with a whole group of students, and they would get into fights with other groups of students and beat them up and things. It was quite a scene. It wasn't like he was just very sweet and always walking around, like, you know. He was also quite a personality. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Yeah, so particles of sound. Just put it in your science folder, and just write down in Srimad Bhagavatam, sound is described as to be made up of particles. You know, just as light, you know, is described as consisting of beams and particles at the same time, isn't it? So who knows? Huh? Of waves. Waves. So now we have waves and wave sound waves and sound particles.